There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Yeah, the last like bad date I went on, I just immediately wrote a short story about it and then sold that for money. So I was like, all right, maybe I'll just do that every time.
Hello and welcome to Love Lives, a podcast from The Independent where I, Olivia Petter, will be speaking to different guests about the loves of their lives. Today, I am so excited to be joined by one of my favourite writers, the brilliant Megan Nolan. Her debut novel, Acts of Desperation, was published to widespread critical acclaim. Now she's back with an excellent new novel, Ordinary Human Failings, and I am so excited to talk to her all about it as well as hearing about the loves of her life. So, welcome, Megan. How are you?
Thank you. I'm very well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for coming. I'm honestly, like I said, I'm such a huge fan of your work. And it was such a treat to read such a different book from you after absolutely falling in love with your first. But it's still equally as compelling and just completely different and so absorbing. So could you start us off by just describing what Ordinary Human Failings is about?
So the present of the novel is 1990 in London, and there's a child who's found dead on a council estate, and there's a reporter who's following this story is the sort of the top line where you enter the book. And then there's an Irish family who are immigrants who've arrived in England about 10 years before this, the child of whom is suspected of having something to do with this crime. And then the tabloid reporter is following this story and then kind of goes back into the three family members' lives in Ireland through previous decades, which is sort of an attempt to give wider context to the troubles in the family that exist in the present and sort of how they've come to this point. And yeah, I suppose the tabloid journalist is sort of the center point that they're sort of brought together by.
Yeah, he's a great character, and you can really, there are so many people just reading in my mind, as obviously as a journalist, like knowing so many people that he's like a proper hack in every single way. And I know that the plot from this book came from a single line in a book that you were reading about a serial killer.
Yeah.
Tell us about that and how that kind of inspired the story.
I've been reading, there's a Scottish, he writes novels as well, but he writes amazing nonfiction called Gordon Byrne. And he wrote this book called Somebody's Husband, Somebody's Son, which is about Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper. It's a really incredible book. Like, I don't know, he's written, you know, I read quite a lot of true crime. Quite a lot of it obviously is, even if it's compelling, it's quite trashy or like not substantial, whereas Gordon Byrne's true crime is like really substantial, and he goes and spends his time in these places. And anyway, so yeah, it's a really brilliant book, and there's quite a throwaway line in it. He doesn't go into the details of what happened, but he mentions at one point that a newspaper, I don't know whether it was like a team of journalists or a single journalist, had approached family members of Peter Sutcliffe's, who would have been by and large quite working class alcoholic people, and approached them and basically offered them a situation in exchange for information from them, which was that they would be put up in a hotel and kind of given free rein in terms of alcohol, given some pocket money, and in exchange they agreed to be kind of sequestered, you know, so they're not allowed to give any info to other journalists. And you just mentioned that was a setup, and I don't know how long it went on in reality or anything like that, but it was just a very striking image, this hotel. And so that was the kind of basis of Ordinary Human Failings, was the kind of first single image, was a hotel with this family being kept. And yeah, again, I don't know in reality how long that situation lasted. And obviously in my book, that contemporary part is only actually, I think, 3 days or something. But that kind of pressure cooker atmosphere of the hotel and them all being cooped up was very striking to me.
Yeah.
So I kind of took that and ran with it.
It's a really interesting concept. It's so unique. And it's interesting what you said, how in the book it was sort of just glazed over as like an insignificant detail. But then when you unpack it, there's so much that could happen within that context. And it's interesting what you said about true crime as well, because I'm not into true crime whatsoever. Like, I know I have friends who are obsessed with it, and it's all they read, it's all they watch, and all they want to do is, you know, listen to murderer stories and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But what you've done with this novel is, as the title suggests, it's a story about the human condition, but it's just within the framework of this kind of true crime story. Mm. And was that kind of also an intentional thing for you? Like, you didn't want to kind of, I guess, stick to the typical version of the genre and, I guess, the more mainstream version that we're so used to digesting?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Because, yeah, I've always, like, I remember being 14 or something and getting my first, you know, Ted Bundy book. And, like, it's not my main thing that I enjoy reading at all, but it's definitely something that I've read fairly consistently over the years. So I'm pretty familiar with both true crime and fiction. And yeah, obviously, the older I got and the more interested in journalism I became, the more complex that whole thing began to seem to me. And then I think it was probably in 2017, I started writing a column for The New Statesman. And my first ever column for them was about this book that I'd read called The Sleep of Reason, a nonfiction book about the James Bulger trial and media response afterwards. And that was sort of a big shock to read. Because I'm Irish, I hadn't been as familiar as probably a lot of people just kind of culturally would be here with that case. And so all of the media response was actually really shocking to me, and that they were named at all. And it's a really brilliant, subtle book about all those nuances that happened after the fact. And then also there was this Channel 4, I think it was probably in 2008 or something like that, there was a program called Boy A, which was adapted from a play by an Irish playwright called Marco Rowe. And that was a kind of fictionalized imagining of, it wasn't actually the James Bulger case, but it was an imagining of a case similar to that of the perpetrator once they're being released as an adult. Right. So there's a couple of things like that I, over the years, had absorbed and kind of become interested in how much more complex these things are than you tend to see them in headlines. And so, yeah, I think that a couple of key kind of things like that came up over the years. And then also I was never a staffer in a newspaper, but I spent time usually just like covering a desk for a couple of weeks at a time. But it meant that I did spend time in quite a lot of different newspapers. And that was, you know, intriguing. And and like, for instance, like, did training days with, I never worked for a tabloid, but I did training days with people who were working for tabloids when I was in a certain building. And I remember being very struck by, like, what we're talking about, Tom. Like, I met this kid, you know, he really was a kid. He was like 20 on a placement or whatever. And he's like, it's like so green and enthusiastic and really sweet. And I was just going like, oh, I hope he's not going to go bad.
I know. Because it is a weird mentality, isn't it? To, like, you know, hear about the murder of a child and be thrilled by
it. Yeah, and be really excited.
Yeah, because your first thought is, oh my God, I've got a scoop. And it's like, that's a very weird psychology to explore.
Totally, yeah.
I know that you said in an interview that you kind of wanted to explore how ordinary people can become capable of doing extraordinary things in this book, which is such an interesting phrase, because I think within this context, because normally we apply that to huge success and positive outcomes and, you know, kind of rags to riches stories, I guess. But within the framework of the book, it's about, you know, that extraordinary thing is an extraordinary act of violence.
Yeah.
And what was it that led you to kind of want to, I guess, explore that? And how did you also go about, I guess, getting into the mindset of that? Because that's also a very dark place to go to.
Having read the book, will know there's like a close third on three of the family members where you really get to see things from their perspective, from Carmel and Richie and John's perspectives. And, you know, initially I was like, should I try and do that with the child as well? But it just didn't feel right. And I think it's really, really hard to pull off portraying a child's perspective in fiction.
Yeah.
Like, I just think it can go so badly wrong if you get it even a little bit like sentimental or like corny or whatever. So I knew I didn't want to go really dark and like actually be in the moment with her when this act of violence is happening. It just felt like crude or something. And also because a lot of the book is about the unknowability of these moments that she has in that time with the other child. There's a lot of commonality between most children who are capable of committing violent acts. There's like quite a lot of crossover in how their childhoods began. And I had read, there's a really great couple of books by a writer called Gita Sereny. who again was a very good nonfiction writer about there's a girl who in the 60s was a child, she was a child who killed two kids called Mary Bell. And Gita Sereny covered that situation when it was happening, but then also when she was an adult. Mm-hmm. And it's really striking how much how repetitive the childhood circumstances are with children who do these things. Mm-hmm. And so I read quite a lot about not just children who've killed, but about children who behave in, you know, aggressive, confrontational ways. And mm-hmm. and so, yeah, I spent a couple of months reading tabloid journalist memoirs and then reading about the kind of psychology behind how children can do this. So yeah, there was, and you don't want to get too prescriptive or like prosaic about that and say, okay, this has to happen for a child to do this.
Yeah.
Obviously it differs in every situation, but there are, you know, fairly basic core things that a child needs that a lot of children don't get, unfortunately. And then some of those children, for a variety of circumstances, tend to be violent. And so, yeah, I was kind of interested in trying to, you know, without condemning the mother, show how like some of that early childhood, not even abuse, but just neglect or benign neglect almost, like, you know, removal from the situation can contribute to the ability to hurt others.
Yeah. And that comes across really well because, like you said, you don't blame the mother and you don't blame any of the family members. And I think that's because you see everything from their perspective as well. Mm-hmm. But this goes back to another question that I wanted to ask you about something that you said about how we're very quick to explain away bad behavior with one reason or one kind of moment from someone's childhood or someone's past. And I think it's not just in terms of bad behavior in terms of crimes, but also just bad behavior within romantic relationships. Mm. I think that is so common now when we talk about attachment theory and you know, all of this like so-called therapy speak that we're very quick to use when we talk about contemporary relationships. And it's like, oh, he's a narcissist and he's emotionally abusive and they're gaslighting me. And these terms are very useful when used correctly, but I think there's this kind of TikTokification of these terms where they're being so loosely applied and we're just so quick to jump to something because I think it's really validating to feel like we have a singular explanation when there's something that we can't make sense of within the context of a romantic relationship. Do you think that that is kind of similar to what you set out to do with this book in terms of trying not to, I guess, have that kind of reductive approach? And do you agree that that is something that we're doing in romantic relationships? And how do we move away from that? Because I don't think it's that helpful.
No, I totally agree, yeah. And I've been like so guilty of that in the past. And I feel like there's, you know, obviously so much has changed in how we talk about relationships in the last 5 years even. Mm. And I think there was a point in this like weird cultural war era, like maybe 5 or 6 years ago, where I was a lot more guilty of like that sort of reductive
way of speaking. Oh God, me too. It's very seductive not to get caught into that.
And I feel like, I feel like things have moved on in the culture a bit, or like are starting to move on right now anyway. And yeah, I don't know. It's like very easy to dehumanize people by speaking that way. Yeah, definitely with the book, because I think it would be. So I think there was an article in the New Yorker not that long ago about like trauma narratives, about like criticizing in fiction mostly, but also I think in just in writing about like taking one trauma and using it to explain everything a person experiences. And I think it would have been I would have hated to just go, okay, Lucy, the child had a bad childhood, that's why she did X, Y, Z, which is why I wanted the whole family story. And also then, as we said a moment ago, to not go, Lucy's mom was evil and that's why she's evil, you know, and that there's obviously so much cruelty in a way, but a lot of it is like, I don't know if you call it unintentional in terms of the family's background, but a lot of pain, which is just then kind of wrapped in silence for them all and ends up hurting a lot of people without active cruelty. So I think it was important to not have like one explaining factor, as you say. I think that would be also it's dangerous to explain anyone's like bad or troubling behavior because, then it's kind of an ability to excuse it in a way or for the person to excuse it and also... Yeah, it's just a bit dehumanizing because it's, I don't know, people are so complex. Like every single person is so, has so much, and like to a degree that's quite scary if you actually think about it. And like that's why we're not really like why the internet isn't actually why like our brains are not ready for it, because it's impossible to like really grasp how like subtle and complex every single person is. And if you're revealed to that many people, it's sort of impossible.
Yeah, well, I was about to say, like, that is all, I agree with you, but you can't put that in like a 20 second TikTok video that people are gonna share with their friends. Let's talk about Acts of Desperation. For those who haven't read your first novel, can you introduce it to us?
So Acts of Desperation is a novel that came out in 2021, which is about, it's a story told in the first person by an unnamed narrator who's a young woman in Dublin, mostly in Dublin, kind of flits a little bit between locations then. And she, when we come to know her, she's, I think, 22 at the beginning, and she's very much adrift in her life. She's dropped out of university, working kind of menial jobs, doesn't really have any center to her life. She's drinking a lot, going out a lot, sort of flailing around her life and looking for some meaning. And she finds it in this relationship. She falls sort of obsessively in love with this man called Kieran, who she meets at a gallery opening, and then becomes embroiled in this obsessive relationship where she is very much the desirer, the one pursuing him, and he's, you know, interested but very cold, and won't give her any of the validation and kind of reciprocity. That's the word, right? That she's seeking. And this kind of goes on like that for a while, and then there's a kind of shift in dynamics in the book then, about maybe halfway through, where some things change, and the dynamic is, if not flipped, is then gradually changed in a way that I think begins to reveal to her that this romantic love that she sort of based her entire worth and point of life around is not going to be the thing that saves her, and that this man is not going to be the thing that gives her meaning.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really like astonishing book to read. And I'm so pleased that something like that has been so well received and has been so widely read, because I think it's not the first thing you think of when you think of a sort of commercially successful book, because it's a story about a woman in an abusive relationship. And I'm really pleased that that story has been so widely kind of shared. Were you surprised at its success?
Yeah, I was hugely surprised. Yeah. Because I guess my background was, I obviously have a journalistic background, but my creative work was kind of separate from that, and was always, you know, in fairly niche literary journals. A lot of the time I was doing like performances in art contexts, and so always in quite, you know, like, and I was happy to do those things. But all of which is to say that when I was trying to sell the book, I kind of thought to myself, okay, great, we'll get it with like a really small press, or like even an art gallery we might produce like a text or something like that.
Yeah.
So I was not expecting it to be sold in a commercial way. So yeah, it was completely a shock to me.
Yeah, and because it was so successful, I mean, you were interviewed loads about it. And what I find so interesting, we know that it's no secret that, you know, female novelists are continually asked if their work is autobiographical, because people don't seem to understand that women have an imagination. But I know one thing that you said that was interesting is that the narrator's feelings and emotions were partially based on you, but the events in the book are fictional, which I think is a very common experience for a lot of debut novelists.
Yeah.
But I wonder what it was like for you talking about the book in that framework and being asked, you know, how much of it was based on your own experiences, because it's a very dark book. And I think what people maybe don't realize what they are essentially asking you by asking you that question is, have you been in an abusive relationship?
Yeah.
Which is a very messed up thing to ask someone. So what did you make of that? How much did that happen? How did you handle that?
Yeah, it's a funny one, because quite a lot of people kind of preempted it by saying that they weren't going to do that, but then sort of doing it anyway. You know, they're kind of like, so I bet you're getting a lot of that.
Right.
So yeah, I've always obviously been quite upfront about, it would be insane if I was to try and like conceal that obviously the book is like personal to me, and also the biographical details of the character mirror mine very closely in terms of like age and where she lives and things like that. And partially that was to do with like me not really feeling the confidence to write, I don't mean this in a like self-derogatory way, but like a proper novel, like as in I didn't have a background in writing fiction. So I think it felt a bit safer to like base some logistics on things that I felt authority over, such as location. And even like, again, with a new novel, I think I'd find it really hard to set a novel in a city I didn't once live in or spend time in. Things like that. So that was partially why. And then also just like I was interested in writing about these subjects that I had experienced myself. And, you know, the events, while largely fictional, of course, there's like some things in the book that actually happened to me or like, and I, by that, I don't even mean like the really interesting stuff. I mean, you know, like observations about people in Dublin or whatever. Mm. But then, yeah, when people would ask me about it, I was like, there's no real satisfying way to answer that question because literally, unless I'd take you to the book and go, that happened, that didn't happen, there's no real way to answer it. You know, I'm not going to break it down to that extreme degree because that just makes the book so boring as well.
Yeah, but I just wonder where that question even comes from, because is it a lack of understanding about a novelist's process as a writer and in terms of how they're able to fictionalize things or whatever, or within the particular story of this book, is it a lack of understanding around like female trauma in a way that they feel like that they can ask things like that? Because yeah. I think it's true with lots of female novelists when they write about difficult subjects and then are kind of expected just to answer questions about it. And I had another example is My Dark Vanessa. I don't know if you read that.
Yeah.
And I remember the author
of that. Yes, that was awful, yeah.
She had to issue a statement on her website saying, please stop asking me whether the story is based on me, because it was a story about grooming. And it was, you know, it was very strange.
That was awful, yeah.
Yeah, and I found it really upsetting that she felt that she had to do that statement.
Yeah, and in a way it's like, well, you know, I wrote a book to not have to
say
these things. Or to like specify certain things or use certain terms, you know, like a lot of the time also people want you to, use specific terminology that's, while it might be accurate, like factually accurate to call something that happened in the book X, Y, and Z, like there's a reason why I wrote the book rather than an article and want to explore those things in a less like determined way. But yeah, it was mostly fine. Like I would say more people than I expected to were respectful of that. Occasionally people were really blunt about asking like, have you been sexually assaulted? And like quite literally, like someone asked me that while on like live on a recording. And I was just
why do you think people aren't like,
I don't know. And she didn't seem to think she was being rude at all.
That's what I mean. Clearly she doesn't. Otherwise she wouldn't ask you. And I'm like, why is it that we live in a world where people think they can ask you that, particularly live? Yeah. I mean, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, that sends shivers down my spine. So I'm writing, I said I wanted to ask you all this because I'm writing my own novel now. And I'm like, oh God, are people going to expect me to talk about that? Both of your books also explore alcoholism.
Yeah.
And I know that you've said that in a small community where you grew up, you kind of really saw the effects of alcoholism and addiction. Is that, what was it about that that made you want to put that into your fiction? Because I think also alcoholism is another subject that is so widely misunderstood. Mm. I think, you know, when we picture an alcoholic, we picture someone waking up and downing a bottle of vodka, but it's so far from the reality.
Yeah.
And that's a problem because it stops people from recognizing their own alcoholic tendencies, I think.
Definitely.
They think they're so far removed. So is that something that kind of made you want to write about it and explore the more kind of nuanced version of that?
Yeah, I think it's really hard to... I've often talked and written a little about this, that like, unless if you're still drinking, if you're currently drinking, it's basically impossible to talk about having a problem with alcohol. Like people really need you to have become sober to allow you to talk about it, which I understand because it's so uncomfortable. But I do think is a really dangerous thing that people feel that they have to be sober and dry before they can even refer to the fact that they struggle with these things sometimes. I felt like when I dropped out of college, I had a really bad period of like, and again, it wasn't like waking up in the morning and drinking, but just like going out every night. And like, because I didn't have any structure to my life then, you know, if you have a job or you go to school or whatever, you kind of have a natural inbuilt limit. And when I didn't have that structure, I got quite scared by how easy it was to get carried away with drinking. And yeah, as well, if you're young, it's like, kind of feels like everyone's doing it, even though they're not maybe doing it to the same degree that you are. It's kind of easy to cover it over. So I have the experience of being really frightened by that and like feeling like it might go really badly wrong, or you might, you know, not know where to stop. And I still struggle with like periods of not feeling completely in control of not just drinking, but with like lots of things in my life that I don't have a very good inbuilt stop button with lots of things. And like sometimes that's work and that's not a bad thing, but sometimes it's things that are bad, you know. So yeah, I just have a lot of sympathy for and time for people who suffer from reliance on substances. And I think, yeah, like the character of Richie in the new book, it again, like starts with him just being a bit lost in his life and not I guess it's also easy to forget that like the reason people start to drink is because it is fun and like is a connector of people. I kind of wanted to portray that a little bit with like him, you know, him before he kind of has this disastrous thing that happens because of his drinking. The night begins in a really nice, lovely way. And then, you know, for a lot of people that would have been fine and they would have had that good time and been able to stop at a certain point. And then obviously a lot of people are not able to stop at that certain point. But yeah, it's something I care a lot about and like feel very personally about. And yeah, there's obviously people that I've known in my life who suffered really horrendously with that. And yeah, I just would like people to have a little bit, you know, I find it really gross when you'll see quite a lot on Twitter if someone's like, I don't know, trying to insult another person who they know to have a drinking problem. Like they're very easy to like use it as an insult and like really be like disgusted by people who have these problems in a way that I find like really anti the generally progressive like vibe that they're trying to portray.
People are very strange about drinking, I think. I think it's one of those things that is very hard for people not to project their own issues onto others with. So like, you know, I think it's one of the reasons why when someone, you know, goes out for the night and doesn't want to drink because it makes them feel a certain way. And you know, they're like, oh, why aren't you drinking tonight? And then it's a big deal because the other person is suddenly made to feel like threatened and feels like, oh, well, do you think like I'm an alcoholic? I'm drinking. Yeah. It's a really weird thing.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Okay, so the first love you chose is quite an obvious choice for a writer, but actually we haven't had this yet from any of the authors we've had on the show. So tell us why you've chosen reading fiction.
So yeah, thinking about my walk here that like, sometimes like when I get into a stressy work mode, which I kind of have been the last couple of weeks, I can't concentrate on reading it very well at all, except for like the most functional or, you know, usually like a magazine article. But last night I read this book called Big Swiss. Have you come across that? Yeah. It's really good. But yeah, just like a really juicy novel. Mm-hmm. And like read almost all of it in the bath in one sitting kind of thing. And I was just thinking about like when I was a kid, I was quite nervous. I wasn't like quite antisocial, like I had friends, but I was quite socially anxious even when I was a really little kid and like didn't know how to behave in certain situations. And I just found like being in the world quite tough, and reading was like back then, you know, as an adult, you develop all these coping mechanisms, some of which are healthy and some of which are not, including drinking and all that stuff. But at the time, like my only coping mechanism was reading. So I just have this very like comfort food relationship with reading fiction, where if I felt really freaked out as a kid, I would just sort of hide. And that was the only thing that could completely take me out of it. And yeah, then as an adult, obviously, like I kind of quite compulsively read fiction. And if I'm stressed, if I can like bring myself to try and concentrate, then reading fiction is the only like really wholesome stress buster that I have.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think I was saying that like I really love those like big kind of sprawling like birth to death novels, like Somerset Maugham or like Dickens. because they, I don't know, it's like very satisfying to feel as like you do not actually feel in real life, that you can kind of have an overarching view of life and have like some sense of narrative purpose, which really does not exist in life.
Order and control.
I
liked what you said when and it's kind of touching on what you said earlier about not having an internal stop button, which I think is something that a lot of people can relate to, but you said that it's, you know, probably one of the only healthy coping mechanisms that you have, but it does do some of what the unhealthy ones do by kind of letting you forget yourself but without the danger or guilt attached. So I want to ask you why you think it's so important that we have that moment of respite where we can kind of like forget ourselves and step outside of ourselves, and why the majority of the things that help us do that are so unhealthy, aside from reading fiction. What else is there? And like exercise or
so partly what Acts of Desperation is about is like doing that with romance, and obviously in Acts of Desperation that's like portrayed as being a negative thing, but obviously it's not only a negative thing. And I find like obviously if you're falling in love or are in love, then that's like the ultimate feeling of being able to escape yourself in a healthy, like joyous way. But on my own, I feel like reading and being with my friends honestly is like the only thing that if I feel really overwhelmed, I just need to be with another person, whether that's through fiction or being with my friend or my partner or whatever it is.
It's just about getting out of your own head.
I'm not very good. I'm incredibly bad rather at like any sort of meditation or just sitting with yourself, like really bad. And I'm trying to get a little bit better, but.
No, I'm so bad at it. I've started doing acupuncture recently.
Right.
One of the worst things about it is that you have to literally lie there for 30 minutes in silence with needles in you.
Yes.
And just lie there. And and my mind is just going like into overdrive because I'm like, I should be relaxing.
Yeah.
There are needles in me. Oh my God, is one moving? I can't. And you have to do that for 30 minutes and it is torture.
Yeah, exactly. And just like last night trying to go to sleep, you know, just lying there for 2 hours being like, I can't stop thinking, you know?
Yeah.
I really struggle with that. And I just find like it's not something I'm happy about necessarily. But yeah, basically being with a person is the only way that I can really guarantee to escape that feeling.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think obviously it's such like a sensorially overwhelming world to live in at the moment. And because we're not so great at being alone, because, you know, our attention spans are shot from living the way we do, it's really hard to find, to like not need a bit of like time out from being overwhelmed by the world, but also not being able to like meditate necessarily. Yeah.
I know. I wish I was one of those kind of wholesome, mellow people.
Me too,
like,
yeah.
I'm just going to go meditate. I'm really stressed right now. And then come back and be like, okay, I'm floating like a butterfly. That's just not who I am.
No.
To be honest, I don't know many writers that are like that. So I was just thinking. I was like, that's why I'm good at my job.
Yeah.
That's why we're good at what we do. Okay, your second love is a family member. Tell us why you've chosen your dad.
So my dad and I are very close. I'm close with all my family, but my dad and I kind of have a special bond because I've got two older brothers who belong to my mum, but they've got a different dad to me. So I'm my dad's only kid, which just means that we spent a lot of time one-on-one when I was growing up. And even though I love all my family equally, we just have a kind of special bond that has to do with those kind of formative years spent just the two of us. Because my mum and dad split up when I was quite young. Me and my dad probably see each other maybe like 4 times a year, but it's like definitely the highlight of my year, getting to spend actual substantial time with him. A lot of the time it's just for a day or two, but at Christmas time, for instance, I always make sure to have like a full week where I can just like do nothing and walk around with him for a couple of days. We're really, really close, and like painfully close, where it's like a big source of sadness in my life, just like worrying about him and like anticipating something bad happening to him, you know?
I have that with, oh God, this is so ridiculous. I have that with my cat.
But I do. I love my cat as well.
It's like an unhealthy like attachment.
Just, yeah, exactly.
But you do, you like kind of catastrophize.
Yeah, like preemptively sometimes. Working through these things.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is like obviously ridiculous because it's going to be awful no matter what happens, like no matter how much you anticipate it.
Yeah.
Which I try to remember. It's like this, you're just wasting your time because it's going to be as bad no matter what, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, so like it's painful as well, but he's definitely like a problem in my life has often been that I feel very like weightless and like insubstantial in the world, or like I don't know where to I don't feel like attached to things in a way that I should maybe. And he's sort of the main foundational part of my life that I feel like if I'm really, and as well, because I've like moved around a lot in my adult life and I've continued to move around a lot. And, you know, I'm not a very settled person in that way, which is obviously by choice more or less, but that comes with a lot of downsides as well as positives. And I feel like my relationship with him is like really crucial to me not feeling completely lost in the world when I am sort of adrift in these ways.
And you said that he's also a writer.
Yeah, he writes plays and directs plays. So yeah.
Is that one of the main things that you think kind of bonds you together just from a kind of, I guess, intellectual point of view? Do you talk about writing?
Yeah, we talk about our work. Mostly, like sometimes about functional things, as in like if one of us has a problem with a certain scene or whatever, we'll discuss it a little bit. But
that's nice.
A lot of the time it's more about like, you know, he's very sensitive like me and like suffers a lot with his work as I do. And I don't mean that in like a tortured artist way. I just mean like, I think it's awful and like struggle to be able to show it to anyone and that kind of thing. And, you know, we both like suffer with confidence quite a lot. So it's sort of, yeah, like trying to bolster each other in that way more so than anything functional. But yeah, he's like, I mean, he was always very supportive of what I wanted to do, but also was like, you know, you're never going to make any money though. So he was like trying to make me aware of the functional downsides, but also like he was like very supportive as well.
Yeah. In terms of the confidence with your writing, how was that different between the first book and the second book? Did you feel like that was an improvement with the second book?
Yes and no. So with the first one, because there were kind of no stakes, because there was no book deal or whatever, I just wrote it in my spare time and then we didn't, you know, show it to any editors until I'd finished it.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So there was like a bit of freedom in that because nobody was waiting for it. So I took like 3 years and just did it in my spare time. So that was like, it was scary still writing it. And like, I didn't feel like, oh, this is brilliant when I was writing it, but it also kind of didn't really feel like it mattered hugely. Yeah. Not that it didn't matter, but like that if it went, if we handed it in and it was bad, it's like, all right, well, I'll just keep on working then. And whereas this one was contracted. So it was a bit scarier in that way because I had a deadline. And also, I'd never written full time before in that way. And I still don't know this, like for the next one, for instance, like is it, you know, you don't know if it's going to be possible to write a good novel in the time that you have allocated.
Yeah.
And there's no way to promise somebody that you will have, you know.
And your third love, I'm so pleased you've chosen this because as you said in your email, I think this is something that is getting pretty bad press at the moment. Tell me why you've chosen dating.
I've always been a huge dating fan. I mean, I came to it quite late as in like I never did any online dating or anything like that until I came to London in 2015, 16, something like that. And I just found, I love meeting new people and it's like, I get a lot of pleasure and energy from random encounters. So this was like, oh wow, it's like very, very easy for me to experience that feeling, which in the past was like a thing that only happened to me rarely. I can now meet new people, you know, sometimes in hopes of finding a partner, but quite often just because it's like fun to meet new people.
Yeah.
And yeah, obviously it does get quite a bad rap at the moment. And I to give a proviso, I do understand that like if you're very, very seriously looking for a partner, I can imagine it would be a lot more demoralizing than I've tended to experience it. But usually, well, like I met my last serious partner on an app. So, it has happened for me in that way. But quite often it's like more of a, not that I'm opposed to meeting somebody seriously, but it's a little bit more haphazard than that. And it's a little bit more like frivolous than that for me. I don't know. I think as well, when I went in, I spent quite a lot of time in New York over the last couple of years, and it's like a really fun way to see the city, basically.
Yeah.
And like meet people there, and people there are like really casual about dating in a way that I really like.
I was about to say, I imagine it's a very different
environment. Yeah, it's just like really spontaneous and a little bit more fun, and I just find it really, I mean, there have been times when I've like, when I've regretted going into situations like say if you leave a serious relationship and then go straight into dating, I found that quite painful because you have to like go into these like online situations with the basic understanding that most people don't, you're basically not being seen as a full person on, you know, you're going into it with both of you not really perceiving the other as a full rounded human being. So if you're leaving like a loving relationship and going into that whole scenario, it can be a bit jarring to be like, wait, why aren't you being really, really nice to me, you know?
Yeah, I think that it's so interesting because it's that gap, isn't it, between when you come out of a serious relationship, when you come out of any kind of meaningful partnership, and then you think, right, I'm just going to go and meet someone, I'm going to get on an app, and you, it's not that, like, you know what you're doing, you know you're on a dating app, and you know that it's sort of like a game and whatever. But I think then the reality of, like you said, sitting down to meet someone, and it's so flippant and it's so casual, and then you might never hear from them again.
Exactly.
They might
it's quite hard to get used to. Yeah.
It's really hard, and it's like the kind of the fall from grace, so to speak, is so dramatic.
Yeah.
How do you, if you have like a bad or disappointing date now, how do you handle that? Do you kind of just write it off as a funny story, or do you just try and move on as quickly as you can and like compartmentalize it?
Yeah, the last like bad date I went on, I just immediately wrote a short story about it and then sold that for money. So I was like, all right, maybe I'll just do that every time.
This is why it's great being a writer.
Like, this is my life in New York. This is how it's going to go. I'll just go on a lot of bad dates and then write short stories about them.
Okay, genius. I'm going to do that as well. Okay, that's great. For people that aren't writers, how do you handle it? Because how do you not, I guess, because it is such a demoralizing experience.
Yeah.
You've had so many disappointing dates, or, you know, you can talk to someone on an app and have such great chemistry, such great conversation, and then you meet them in real life and it's just zero. It's just, there's no spark, there's nothing.
Yeah.
How do you pick yourself back up from that, or like just motivate yourself to keep trying, whether it's on an app or not, but just how do you stop yourself from spiraling into that place where you think, this is pointless, I'm just going to be alone forever, which is unfortunately the dark, traumatic places that your brain goes to.
I had some really good advice. I mean, it's very simple advice, but kind of needed to hear it from a good friend of mine. After he's in New York, and then I'd gone there in 2020, just out of a relationship, and long-term, very, you know, loving, happy relationship. And we had an amicable breakup, but obviously it was upsetting. And then I was going on these dates, many of which were really fun. And like, I'm still actually really close friends with several of the guys that I went on a couple
of dates
with back then. But then obviously, like went on a bunch of shitty ones as well. And then I went around to my friend Orlando, who's like my oldest friend. He's an old friend of mine from Ireland, but he lives in New York now and has been there a long time. And kind of went to his house and was like complaining about these feelings and like how bad it felt to go on some date or other. And he was like, well, yeah, again, like what we were just talking about, basically, he was like, well, of course you feel bad because you're like, going from being around the person who loved you to being around this person who doesn't. And actually, you should just be with people who love you right now, like me, you know, like, like you. And actually, that was the only thing that made me feel better after those things, was like, oh, I'll just go and be with people who love me, like my friends. And and I know that sounds like very, very trite and like, oh, your friends are all you need, which is like not actually how I feel.
That's also not what you're saying, but that's a really good point, I think, just generally.
Yeah, like if you're in need of a bit of care, that's totally fair. And like, you should access that in a different way and like save the dating for just like some frivolous fun when you're ready for that, you know?
Yeah, I think you just have to accept that if you're looking for kind of instant care and love and like warmth, you're just not going to get that on Hinge.
No, it's not going to be very attractive if you are either.
That's it for today. Thank you so much for listening. You can listen to all episodes of Love Lives on all podcast platforms. You can also watch us on independent TV and all social media platforms and all connected devices. I will see you soon. Bye.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.